Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, how new science is making bioweapons that bit more easy to manufacture. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. First up, as always, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Shane Bergen, a physicist and science communicator at UCD, and Dr. Shelley Brady from the Insight Centre at DCU. You're both very welcome. Shane, this first story is pretty huge. I mean, it's big.
Is it the moon?
It is the moon, yeah.
Yes, Jonathan, this is a big one. I'm afraid I have to tell you something that we've discussed on the show many times. We now know a little bit more. The moon was an inside job. That is a publication from Science this week, the journal Science. And it basically looks at the origins of the hypothesized planet Theia that crashed into the early Earth 4.5 million years ago and is thought to have created the moon.
So just back up there, what you're saying is there was the idea was that some object smashed into the moon, smashed into the Earth, broke off a bit, and over time became the moon.
Yeah, exactly. So a Mars-sized object hit the Earth, and as a result of it, it radically changed the Earth and caused the formation of the moon. And the Mars-sized object in the process kind of was amalgamated into the Earth and the moon. So it no longer existed after the collision, which tells you an awful lot about the energy of it. But we'd no idea as to where this planet Theia.
Are we sure about that? That we now feel like we're 100% on?
Well, we're never really 100% on things unless you're a mathematician, but we're becoming more and more confident about it. What we can tell from this paper is the likelihood as to where this planet may have come from. So we think now that this is from the study from Science, is that we're able to say that it came from the inner solar system. So this big planet would have most likely existed closer to the sun than the Earth is. And we're able to do that by looking at the isotopes, the metals that it deposited in the Earth after the collision. So when the Earth was formed, heavy metals like iron and molybdenum would have gone to the core, to the center of the Earth. Therefore, any metals that are in the mantle, which is further out, would have come from this collision with Theia. And by looking at those metals in our mantle, which we can do, we can take samples from volcanoes and whatnot, we're able to tell where in the solar system the originator planet may have come from. And we're able to do that because the type of isotope you get in any metal depends typically on how far away from its constituent star it was.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is really cool, right? So an isotope, yeah, is kind of a different flavor of the same element for listeners. But we're able to tell because of the isotopic makeup of the metal in our mantle and similar samples taken from the Apollo mission on the moon, we're able to tell where that early planet came from. And we can say now with some confidence that it came from between us and the sun, which I think is remarkable that they're able to do this kind of reverse engineering at a planetary scale.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. I have to say, when I was studying isotopes for chemistry in my leaving many, many, many years ago, I was thinking, I will never hear the word isotope again. But actually, it keeps on coming up, doesn't it? And the idea that, as you say, these different flavors of atoms, so we have these different elements and isotopes are basically slightly different versions of them with a slightly different subatomic makeup, but essentially the same element, that we can learn so much from them about you know, how old something is or where something's come from in the universe is absolutely extraordinary. And so this object collided into Earth, created the moon as a sort of a backsplash, but there's no third party, we don't think. There's no a bit that continued on into orbit as far as the current guessing is go?
No, we no sense of that. That it was entirely.
How could you have sense of it though?
Well, you might see that there might be a remnant of it, right, within the solar system as a meteor or an asteroid or something like that. But there's no sense of that. Also, the moon is absolutely huge. So the ratio of the size of the moon to the Earth is enormous compared to the moons of most other planets. So it's quite logical that all of the mass of that planet, you know, when it hit the Earth, it reformed the Earth itself and caused the moon. If you add up the mass of the Earth and the moon, and then the early Earth and this Mars-sized planet, they're about the same.
All right. Okay. Our second story, Shelley, is really interesting because everybody will be familiar with this sound. This is, of course, the lion from MGM Studios and a very familiar sound. The sort of sound of a lion that we learn from our childhood, you know, when we press those books that play little sounds, this is exactly what we would hear. It's on all the toys where you press the button and the lion makes a roar. And we do this over and over again, particularly when it comes to underestimating animals. We just thought that's the sound of a lion, but actually it turns out there is more.
Yeah, absolutely. So this story is all about the acoustic analysis of the African lion roar. And what they've done is they used AI. And this really grabbed my attention, Jonathan, because at the moment, some of the research I'm involved in is looking at dog bark analysis using some of the same methods and through machine learning. But these scientists have been eavesdropping on a much bigger beast. So lions, as you say, they roar, but they also use different types of sounds. So they mew, snarl, chuff and grunt. But it's the roar, as you say, is the most iconic and recognizable sound produced in the animal kingdom. And this study was called Roar Data, Redefining a Lion's Roar Using Machine Learning. And what it's shown is that the roar of the African lion isn't one-dimensional. So for decades, it's been thought that lions had this single kind of full-throated roar, that one that we're really, really familiar with. And they use this for territory and for mating and for communication. But what they've done is they've taken loads and loads of field recordings, tens and thousands of field recordings, and they've used machine learning and they've discovered a second class of roar, which they've called the intermediary roar. So it's shorter, it's lower pitched, and it carries vocal signatures that are actually unique to each animal. So that was previously lumped in with the main roar, but now what they're able to do is actually identify each animal through its intermediary roar. So this was all done in Tanzania. And what they did was they put these acoustic collars onto the lions and they focused on how long the utterance lasted, how high the pitch was, and then they were able to build this algorithm that was capable of classifying each type of roar with really high precision.
But just to pause there for a second, Shelley, you know, with your work analysing the barking of dogs, like surely the anatomy of the throat and the innards of a lion would mean that every roar is identifiable to that lion, that every roar is essentially a fingerprint. I think it would be crazy to think that that they would all be identical. So given enough precision, surely we would always be able to identify a roar and attach it to a particular lion.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. And what they were able to do, I suppose, was look at the subtle differences that are jumping out. And yes, humans are able to do this to a certain extent, but not to the same extent that can be done within AI. And the AI, of course, would outperform any human that is trying to listen and identify particular lions. And what's really helpful about this is that because they've been able to decode the roar into the component parts, and they're able to tell the voice of one lion from another, conservation groups might be able to count and track lions by sound alone, which would be really valuable, especially at the moment when their habitats are shrinking. There's a lot of poaching pressures. So it would mean being able to count them without disturbing them.
Yeah. Just in terms of the nature of the roar, like, does this roar tell us anything different about how they communicate? I mean, I always think it's crazy that we assume that animals only have a couple of ways of vocalizing when we have ourselves, you know, developed a very complex voice pattern, and over millennia and millions and millions of years, these animals have also evolved and communicate with each other. The idea that that language isn't very rich doesn't really sit well with me. Do we know what this particular call means? Is it a warning call? Is it a distress call?
They don't know.
Right.
So because the recordings lack that behavioral context, they still can't say why they're choosing one roar type over another. No. So what they need to do is have enough recordings in known contexts to be able to work that out and figure out why lions roar more loudly in certain situations. But just to give you a little bit of, I suppose it's pub quiz Hollywood trivia about the MGM lion, Jonathan. So there's no intermediary roar there, and that's for one simple reason. It doesn't belong to a lion at all. So in a bit of Hollywood movie magic, those sound designers opted for something more ferocious, and the MGM lion roar is actually from a tiger.
And the lion, yep, was born in Dublin Zoo. His name was Leo, the lion.
That's right.
Shane, I did know that. I was going to use that fact, Shane, actually. Thanks a lot. It's a tiger. No way.
Yeah.
That is mad. And they got the lion to lip sync it. God, they can do anything with animal training these days. That's incredible. All right. Our next story has to do with weight loss drugs, Shane. And we've talked a lot on this program about the incredible benefits of some of these weight loss drugs. And it extends far much more than simply reducing an obesity epidemic. We've seen the trickle down effects in terms of heart attack rates in the United States. This study does raise a question about what happens if you come off certain drugs. Talk to me about this study.
Yeah, you're right to say these are remarkable family of drugs, and the changes they have on people's lives are profound. This is a clinical trial called SURMOUNT 4, published in the journal JAMA, and it's looking specifically at Mounjaro. It has the active ingredient tirzepatide. And basically what they looked at was what happens if you stop taking the drug rather rapidly. What they see in previous research has shown is that the weight that you have lost can be regained rather rapidly. But what this clinical trial looks at is the effect on those other secondary effects. So reduced blood pressure or lower levels of so-called bad cholesterol. And perhaps it's not a surprise, because those things, doctors say, are often linked to obesity. So what they did in the study was that they found people who were on the weight loss drug for 36 weeks, and then half of the group were taken off it and put on a placebo. The other half stayed on it, and both groups for a year. And they focused on 308 people who had lost 10% of weight after a year, and they found that 82% regained 25% or more of the weight after the year. And unfortunately, the effects on those other indicators of health were going in the wrong direction as well. And they found the rate at which you regain weight will also impact significantly the rate at which those other factors will deteriorate, such as cholesterol and blood pressure. So I would flag that the manufacturer of the drug was involved in this study, but that's not unusual by any means. And of course, every ethical and peer review step would have been taken. But what they're saying is that it would be quite unwise to come off this drug very, very rapidly. And it doesn't, perhaps unsurprisingly, again, it doesn't seem to suggest that behavioral change is a consequence of taking the weight loss drugs. You don't change your behavior. It's just that it suppresses your appetite, your drive to eat, and that will or could return if you stop.
So there's enormous work to be done here, I think, in understanding how once you've lost the weight, you then adapt to this new way of living, eating and exercising, and whether or not that is actually possible. But understanding how to wean off any sort of drug so that you're not dependent on it for the rest of your life is absolutely crucial. And I think there's an enormous amount of work now to follow on from these GLP-1 drugs to see where and how we can help people who have decided that they want to lose weight, have gone to their clinician, gotten the drug in question, managed to lose the weight because of the drug's effects, and then then to continue down the path of keeping a weight that is healthier for them. So lots of work to be done in that area. Our final story, Shelley, is a little bit lighter. It's to do with hot tubs.
Yeah, so at the moment in Ireland, if you visit pretty much any open body of water, more than likely you're going to come across a sauna. Sea dipping, wild swimming, it's all exploded in popularity. So anyone who does enjoy jumping into the freezing cold sea and following it up with a sauna might be interested to hear about this new study from the University of Oregon. So what they've done is they've studied sauna activity and compared it to other ways that we warm up our bodies. So it looked at time spent soaking in hot tubs, and then they compared it with traditional dry saunas and a modern infrared sauna. And then they looked at the acute responses between the three, which I was really surprised hasn't been done before. It's a small study. It's only involved 10 men and 10 women. They were aged between 20 and 28, and they all exercised regularly. So these were young, fit people, which allowed the researchers to really focus on specifically how each heat method affect a young healthy population. And it turns out that, what do you think maybe would have the most health benefits?
Well, I will put my hand up and say I've read this, so I know.
Okay.
But I would have thought a sauna. I would have thought a sauna.
So would I.
I would have thought, you know, there's something a bit icky sometimes about a hot tub. And I don't know, I would have thought, you know, just you don't stay in a hot tub as long. I would have thought sauna, and your pores are sweating out. I don't know. I would have thought sauna.
Yeah, and I think we hear so much about the health benefits of saunas at the moment. But it turns out that it's soaking in hot water. So this triggers stronger physiological benefits than sitting in a traditional dry or infrared sauna. And when they analyzed the blood samples, they found that this hot water immersion actually raised core body temperature more effectively, it boosted blood flow, and it ramped up immune responses, and it produced measurable changes in inflammation markers. And these are all things that a sauna will do as well, just not to the same degree. And they think the reason for this is because when you're immersed in hot water, you're submerged, and your body can't effectively dissipate the heat. So your core temperature is staying elevated for longer. And when you're in a sauna, your body is coming into contact with the air, so your body can sweat to cool down. And this just isn't the case when you're underwater. So that persistent heat stress is triggering vascular, immune, and metabolic responses that you just don't quite get from a sauna.
Yeah, the whole core temperature thing is fascinating. You know, that with kids start off and they've got a much lower core temperature range. Mm. You know, that could be as low as 36.5 degrees, and then it goes up to 37, and then as you get older it goes back down again. But how our body regulates this, and this whole idea of homeostasis, which is something I don't remember from school, but I think they teach it now, it's so fascinating how our body is able to fix the inner temperature to make sure that we always stay exactly at 37 degrees as adults. It's the human body is an incredible thing. All right, well, I'm Dr. Shelley Brady from DCU, and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen, thank you so much for joining us. So this week at the World Forum, leaders across the world discussed the developments in science that perhaps we don't talk enough about. And those are to do with the use of new science to use as weapons. According to experts right now, new advances in neuroscience, pharmacology, and AI are opening the door to tools that could confuse, sedate, or even manipulate human behavior with unprecedented precision. It sounds like science fiction, but it really is a genuine concern that's being discussed at the highest levels of state across the world. Joining us now is Malcolm Dando. He's a neuroscientist and emeritus professor at the School of Social Sciences at the University of Bradford. He's a new book called Preventing Weaponization of CNS Acting Chemicals. Thank you so much for joining us, Malcolm. Perhaps maybe you might tell us a little bit about why the heads of state across the world were meeting at the World Forum on this particular subject, and give us a bit of a background to what we're talking about, because the idea of using these drugs to manipulate human behavior has long been the subject of, you know, hypothetical science fiction stories and movies, but now we're getting closer to that being a reality.
So the Chemical Weapons Convention was agreed about 30 years ago in the early 1990s, and it was regarded as one of the real achievements of disarmament and arms control of the last century. And in 2015, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons because it had effectively verified the destruction of all declared chemical weapon systems, the huge amounts of which had been built up during the last century. This is a very positive convention. It's very optimistic. It meets each year for a conference of the state parties. All the state parties come to The Hague and they review the present situation and what needs to be done. And of course, these kind of issues are never settled, because if you think about it, 30 years ago, the revolution in the biological and chemical sciences was just beginning to get underway. We were all beginning to talk about genetic engineering. We'd not yet got to genomic engineering and the human brain project. But this kind of rapid advance in science and technology was beginning to become obvious. And from the beginning of the convention, there were concerns amongst civil society about possible loopholes in the convention. Article 1.5 of the Chemical Weapons Convention says that you shall not use riot control agents as a method of warfare. And it's quite obvious why that was in there, because if you think back to the First World War, we saw that when the stalemate occurred on the Western Front, people started using less than lethal chemical weapons to try to force opposition soldiers out of their trenches. And then that degenerated into ever more dangerous chemical weapon systems being used.
Yeah, so I can understand why that sentence would be there, but I'm not even a lawyer, but I can see the problems in it. Specifically labeling it as warfare allows for other scenarios to be potentially theoretically permissible. Agents and molecules that affect the central nervous system in a negative way are not necessarily new to just actually poison someone with these sort of things. That's not a particularly new thing. We've known that those chemicals have been around for a while. But the wording of some of this language that's in your book, the idea that we could actually confuse or manipulate human behavior with these sort of chemicals, that is to me of great interest. So talk to me about how we know that this is possible and who is doing the experiments to prove that.
What we do in the book is examine some of the work that's been done trying to understand what psychedelics do to the large-scale neuronal networks in the higher brain centers. And that is proceeding really quite rapidly, and it's beginning to become clear how that's working. So that was one example. The other example was even more fascinating, at least to my mind. We always used to have a dogma which said that the brain is isolated from the immune system. So the immune system can do what it wants to, but it can't get into the brain. That turns out to be wrong. And now in the book, we example a set of essays in a book published by Cambridge University Press and a set of essays produced by Oxford University Press, both on immunopsychiatry, so about how changes in the immune system can affect really high-level processes within the brain. And we give examples of the kind of things that medics are beginning to understand about some kind of really quite complex psychiatric disorders are actually caused by a disruption in the body's immune system. And the interesting thing, of course, is that the immune system, when it attacks something, is really quite specific. So you know that there's a disease called narcolepsy, narcolepsy type 1, which involves people, unfortunately, just in normal behavior, all of a sudden collapsing, loss of muscle tone. And it's quite clear from the evidence that we have from both human and animal studies that this can be caused by the loss of just one set of neuropeptide producing cells within the brain. This orexin neuropeptide, its actions are complex, but what it does is stabilize the wake state.
How do you weaponize something like that, though, Malcolm?
Well, I'm a biologist by background, okay? So if you have a look at the ongoing literature in biology, there's some fascinating stuff being done on neuroparasitism. There are example after example in nature of parasites which modify the behavior of their host for their own advantage. They don't know they're doing it, it's just it works that way. So in evolution, it's clear that this is possible.
Right, but in those instances, right, they're typically, you know, we're talking about insects, we're talking about T. gondii, certain parasitic microorganisms. They, you know, the way in which they control their hosts is very uniform and singular-minded, right? So they, for example, a T. gondii gets inside a mouse and removes its inhibition around cats, for example, and in that particular instance, of course, the cat gets the mouse, and the T. gondii gets to go back into the cat gut where it wants to reproduce. But that, in terms of humans, that just wouldn't work. I mean, you know, a human that that had a singular purpose like that wouldn't necessarily work, would it? Or do you think that with a complex mind like a human's brain, we might be able to influence behavior using this sort of mechanism?
Well, what I would put it the other way around. Given the rate of advance in the relevant science and technology, we would be foolish to assume that it wasn't possible. So given that, then let's not go down that road.
Yeah. But again, we're going back to this idea of, you know, a convention that, you know, states are signing up to agreements that they all expect the others to sign up to. And, you know, if I think about the United States have stepped out of a number of different conventions, and they are, you know, they're theoretically, you know, the self-proclaimed leaders of the free world. If you think about other states that maybe are likely to want to jostle for more power, or just perhaps want to prepare themselves for the new world that they find themselves in, and like the idea that none of these countries are actually doing underground secret experiments developing these sort of weapons and technologies, I think is it not a bit naive? And the idea that they would say they're going to sign up to this convention, is that just, you know, empty talk when the prize could be the ability to subvert or incapacitate a leader, with extreme precision? I mean, that just seems like too big a prize for state leaders to not be doing some research on the side. It is both terrifying and fascinating in equal measure. If you want to get really deep into this book, you'll really get a huge background to what the problem is now and what is theoretically possible using the technology and science of today. It's called Preventing Weaponization of CNS Acting Chemicals. The authors are Michael Crowley and Malcolm Dando. Malcolm, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Very interesting stuff. Love to hear your thoughts on that as well. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or tweet us, we're @NewstalkScience. That's it from us in this week's Future Proof. Thanks to producer Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof on Tuesday in your podcast feed. Have a great Sunday.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on Newstalk.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger fuel centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.